People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Imagine it's your 18th birthday, you have a piece of cake, and then the door opens, the lock is changed, and if you have luggage or green garbage bags full of your clothes, you're asked to leave. So, I mean, that's people think, well, that's kind of a ridiculous example. It's actually not. This is exactly what has happened and continues to happen to many kids from care.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. You just heard the voice of Jackie Gahagan. She's a university professor in Nova Scotia, and she's also a former youth in care. When the state is your parent, what happens when you grow up? It's a question the Senate of Canada's Standing Committee on Human Rights has been looking into. They've put out a new report that calls the current situation a crisis. On today's program, we'll hear from a trio of folks who spoke with that Senate committee, each of whom has their own past experience as a youth in care, and each of whom has spent time in their professional lives advocating to improve the system. We'll hear about what the issue looks like, why it matters, and what the Senate is proposing to do about it. Let's get to it.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jackie Gahagan. I'm joining you from beautiful Mi'kma'ki here on the east coast of Canada in Halifax, Nova Scotia. I am the Associate Vice President Research at Mount St. Vincent University, and I am the Principal Investigator on a SHRC Partnership Development Grant looking at how tuition waivers are helping to reduce barriers in access to post-secondary education.
And we're going to be talking about the issue of youth aging out of care today. Where do you think we should begin to help people understand the scope of this problem?
That's a really great question, Joe, in part because in the early days of our project, which started in 2022, we wrote a piece in the Conversation Canada about the need to support kids coming out of care to make sure they don't fall through the cracks, including things like tuition waivers and other wraparound supports. And for the first time in my career, I received hate mail from people saying, why should we care about these kids? They're not my problem. I can barely afford my own kids' expenses. And so what was interesting, it was hard to hear that, hard to read those comments, but what was telling from that is the cost of investing now in kids coming out of care in terms of their access to post-secondary education is a far better investment, ethically, financially, however you want to look at it, than waiting for those kids to fall through the cracks even further and end up in the criminal justice system, which, as we know, is not a very cost-effective way of dealing with social issues that could be dealt with by investing in primary prevention. So, in other words, support kids coming out of care so that they don't end up on the streets in poverty and in many instances in conflict with the law.
What are some of the ways that that could be happening right now? What are some of the issues? What does it look like when someone actually ages out of care?
Well, I mean, a great question. It depends on where you spent time in care and where you ultimately are ending your time in care, because aging out of care is complicated by sort of in what province is age of majority. And if you hit age of majority at, say, 18, what does that mean for you suddenly going from the state as your parent to being parentless and in some cases homeless as a result of that? So it doesn't look good. So no matter how you try and sort of frame the issue, aging out of care has significant consequences. So whether it's 18, 19, or 20, that has consequences for readiness to take on all of the responsibilities as an independent adult. And as we know, many kids with a parent or two parents don't suddenly wake up on their 18th birthday and leave the house and start adulting someplace else. So really that the fact that the state is your parent until you reach age of majority and you age out, and then it's up to you to figure out your own journey from there. And that is an extraordinary burden to put on basically what are essentially kids.
We're going to jump over to Montreal, where I reached the executive director of a national organization advocating for youth in care.
Hi, my name is Dr. Melanie Doucette. I am the executive director of a newly established national nonprofit organization by and for people with lived experience in the Child Welfare System called the National Council of Youth and Care Advocates. I am located in Montreal, Quebec, on the unceded traditional territory of the Mohawk Nation. I'm originally from New Brunswick, so I'm Acadian, and that's where I was placed into foster care. So I have lived experience as well, and I aged out at age of majority. So this issue is very personal for me, and yeah, I have a lot to say about it.
Doucette says reaching adulthood can cause an abrupt transition for youth in care.
A lot of young people from care, they don't have the same kind of family support system that most kids have when, you know, they reach 18 or 19. So there's a big difference, I guess, in how young people in the general population get to transition to adulthood versus people in care. Because in care, it's not really a transition. It's a hard cutoff. It's an aging out process. And you kind of have to figure things out on your own with very little to no supports and also no family support system in the traditional sense. For kids in the general population, parents don't just go, hey, you're 18 or 19 now, so I've done my job and here's a garbage bag of your belongings. Out the door you go and don't call, don't email, don't text. You're completely on your own now. Good luck and goodbye. So that's kind of the picture of what youth in care have to go through when they age out of the system. So it's not really something that should be normalized, but it's unfortunately something that happens because it's been legislated like that.
What can you tell me about what we know is happening to youth who have experienced that on maybe a nationwide level?
Yeah, so of course, if you're going to propel people with, you know, little to no supports, people who are also very traumatized because they're victims of abuse, of neglect, and also, you know, the time during the system is not all hunky-dory either. A lot of youth have experienced multiple placements, which means multiple school changes sometimes. So a lot of instability, a lot of attachment breakdowns. And those things don't magically kind of get resolved just because you've reached 18 or 19. So oftentimes, young people carry this kind of trauma and abandonment with them as they transition to adulthood. And the fact that they don't have a solid support system surrounding them during their transition to adulthood kind of further impacts this sense of isolation and being completely alone. And so what happens for youth in care, the statistics and studies that have been done on what happens to them after they age out of care don't paint a very pretty picture. It's actually quite grim when you compare it to youth in the general population. So they're overrepresented in the youth homelessness population. There was a survey that was done by the Canadian Observatory on Homelessness on youth homelessness in Canada in the recent years, and they found that homeless youth were 200 times more likely to have been in the child welfare system than you know, other youth. So that we're very much overrepresented in the homelessness population. There's also a very high overrepresentation in the criminal justice system. What tends to happen for youth in care is they're either forced to survive, and sometimes that entails breaking the law in order to survive. People on the streets also get criminalized for being homeless. They get tickets and things like that, and that they can't pay. And then they end up in the system. Their trauma and their behaviors that are associated with that trauma also can get criminalized. So unresolved mental health issues, unresolved trauma can get criminalized, and youth end up in jail because sometimes they do become de facto mental health institutions. And so young people from care also overrepresented in that. The level of post-traumatic stress disorder for youth in care is also incredibly high. And there's studies that have shown that it's comparable in terms of rates to Vietnam War veterans. So that's very high, very significant. And the supports and services that they receive, if they received any before aging out of care, gets cut off at the age of 18 or 19. So imagine, you know, you're a young person, you've been seeing a therapist or a psychologist, you have figured out your balance of medication if you're on any. And then at 18 or 19, you lose all health coverage and you're no longer able to access those services and pay for your medication. So those are the types of situations that young people from care find themselves in. And also the starting point oftentimes in adulthood is poverty, because young people, again, don't have parents to call and say, hey, I can't afford my rent this month, or I need some help to buy groceries. Can you help me out? And so oftentimes young people will have to resort to apply for social assistance, and that puts them kind of in a cycle of poverty that they can't really get themselves out of. Another thing that is also not like the same as youth in the general population is education. When you look at the studies that have shown the rates of even high school graduation compared to youth in the general population, it's less than half of youth aging out of care that have obtained their high school diploma, compared to 85-90% of youth from the same age range in the general population. And then the rates of post-secondary education are even lower, less than 2% enroll in post-secondary education because of that lack of support to be able to actually succeed in post-secondary education. So there's a lot of inequities when it comes to youth in care. And it's because the safety net just isn't there, and the system has kind of set it up so that they experience these negative life outcomes after they've aged out because of the lack of supports.
This is one of those systems that is going to be different for someone depending on which province they live in Canada. What can you tell me about some of those differences?
Yeah, I think the way that Canada is structured, because the provinces and territories have jurisdictional power over child welfare services, that means it's really up to each province and territory to determine how, if at all, they want to support youth beyond the age of majority as they transition to adulthood. So it looks completely different from one end of the country to the other. So, for example, if we look at British Columbia, the SAGE program that's in place there right now, they offer supports for some youth who are eligible up until their 27th birthday. If we go to Ontario, they have the Ready, Set, Go program that was launched a couple of years ago that supports youth up until their 22nd birthday. If we go further east, we have, for example, the PATH program in Nova Scotia, which was also established a few years ago. That supports some youth up until the age of 24. So it really varies from province to province, territory to territory. And some places actually don't even have any official post-majority support programs in place. So that means hard cutoff at age of majority.
As you alluded to there, there are some provinces that in recent years have been adopting new measures that are aimed to offer some kinds of support to make them available to some youth up to some point in their 20s. Is there anything you can tell me about those efforts? Anything you think it's important people know about them?
Yeah, I think the pandemic kind of opened the eyes of a lot of people, including policy decision makers. When it comes to youth in care, I think we saw a lot of gaps and cracks in our social support systems during the pandemic. And for youth in care, that was also the case. So myself and the members of the National Council of Youth in Care Advocates, we actually formed in 2020 during the pandemic. And this was kind of a first time that we were able to get together virtually. I'm not sure why we weren't doing virtual things before the pandemic, but the pandemic also opened kind of that window of mobilizing nationally. And so we got together in March 2020 to demand for governments to establish emergency measures and moratoriums for youth aging out of care, because we were really concerned. Health Canada was making all these announcements telling people to like shelter in place and the CERB and all of that. And then for youth in care, there was nothing. It was like silence. And we were like, well, how is that fair? You're just going to let young people just go on the streets, you know, in the middle of an unprecedented pandemic. So we did a lot of engagement, like with the media. We wrote op-eds, we wrote letters to ministers, And we were actually successful in quite a few jurisdictions across Canada in getting moratoriums, temporary moratoriums, which means like halting aging out, so allowing youth to shelter in place and to continue receiving services, and emergency measures as well. Those were implemented in British Columbia. But what happened for us after we were successful in the first 6 months of advocacy in getting those moratoriums in place, we were like, okay, what happens when those expire or when the pandemic is over or is determined to be over by the authorities? What happens then? Do we just go back to the way things were being done before, which we know from all those studies that I mentioned earlier, you know, it's not working. The status quo isn't working. It's not working for the youth, and it's not working for the government either. So that's why we decided to shift towards longer term solutions to really change the system in itself and how it supports young people transitioning to adulthood from care. And we came up with what we call the equitable standards for transition to adulthood for youth in care. So this is something that's very much a framework by and for people with lived experience. And we also wanted to establish standards because they don't exist actually at this time in Canada. There's no actually like guaranteed standard of service and support that youth have a right to access. This is something that we're advocating for to be established in Canada so that no matter where you live, you get that same guarantee access to supports and services that you need. And we're also, well, there was no bar, but we're setting a bar, and we're setting it high so that young people are given the supports that they need to thrive, not just barely survive, which is kind of what is happening now. The programs that are provided are oftentimes piecemeal. They have restrictive eligibility criteria. They have deadlines, timelines, and not all youth are benefiting from them. So we're advocating for more equitable support so that we can start seeing outcomes that are comparable to youth in the general population.
You're listening to People First Radio. On today's program, we're exploring the issue of youth aging out of care across Canada. It's the subject of a recent report from the Senate of Canada's Standing Committee on Human Rights. That report is called Nothing to Celebrate: The Crisis of Youth Aging Out of Care. As you heard Melanie Doucette explaining just prior, many provinces in Canada have made reforms since the pandemic to extend support to some youth through a portion of their 20s. BC has a new program called SAGE, which stands for Strengthening Abilities and Journeys of Empowerment. The program offers former youth in care a monthly stipend of up to $1,250 a month between their 19th and 20th birthdays. That monthly support can be extended up until a person is 27 if they are enrolled in eligible post-secondary, vocational, life skills, rehabilitative, or cultural programming. SAGE also offers counseling benefits, medical benefits, and enhanced dental and optical benefits, as well as life skills funding and potentially housing supports. I spoke with someone in BC who advocated for the changes implemented in the province.
My name is Jessica Knutson. I'm Cree Métis and an urban Indigenous community member living on Coast Salish territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. I grew up on the unceded territory of the Sealk Okanagan peoples. I also a lived experience advocate and social worker, have my own experience in the child welfare system, and have been working in community in different capacities over the years, including harm reduction and support work in child welfare, as well as more recently around Indigenous-specific anti-racism education and systems change in the healthcare settings.
Knutson says she'd advocate for readiness indicators as opposed to age-based indicators as the determining factor for when a former youth in care stops receiving support. But she says the SAGE program nonetheless represents an improvement for former youth in care.
being able to go up until your 27th birthday is longer than any other province or territory has for post-majority services. So really, you know, even though there is always room for improvement and growth in ways that can that youth can be better supported, really wanting to highlight the immense effort, particularly from the youth and care community around this advocacy that's gotten us to this point where we do have these more extended services.
Knutson says she's interested in seeing how many former youth in care access the programs over the coming years, and she highlighted the overrepresentation of Indigenous people within the child welfare system in BC.
BC does have our more fulsome post-majority services than a lot of other provinces. And that, you know, has been a labor of love from the youth and care community for advocating for these changes, and that there is extended supports and that it does help people. And that is the truth. So it'll be interesting to see once there's, you know, been a little bit more time under the new SAGE program about how many youth are actually able to access it. Is there more youth who are able to? But it still probably won't be, you know, 100% of youth who are able to access this program. I think, and again, this is true across the country of and particularly when we're talking about in BC, you know, 70% of youth in care are Indigenous. And so a lot still to this day, a lot of the programming, the policy, the education that child welfare staff are receiving still isn't focused around Indigenous children, youth, families, and communities, isn't focused on, you know, the fact of actually addressing why child welfare exists in the capacity that it does, which is around the continued assimilation and genocide of Indigenous peoples. Like, we got to this point to have such an overrepresentation of Indigenous children and youth in care for certain reasons, because of colonization and continued colonial policies, is still a part of this programming. Like, the Indigenous thought leadership and inclusion of Indigenous youth and communities and developing what SAGE looked like, was it as fulsome as it should have been, considering the fact that 70% of youth in care are Indigenous? No, like, we're still not at the point where we're having the conversations and doing, and that the engagement to create these things isn't being done in the way that it should regarding that. And, you know, you see that in different reports that have come out, like from the Representative for Children and Youth in their No Time to Wait Part 2 report. They talk about, like, how the education and professional development of child welfare workers is still not focused enough to the extent around working with Indigenous youth and communities as it should be. And so when we think about some of these things, like, is SAGE addressing the overrepresentation of Indigenous youth? Is it meeting the needs of Indigenous youth? Again, because that's 70% of the folks who are in and aging out of care. Like, I don't think that that part has been it's not where it should be to be able to address the needs of youth who are aging out. And so, you know, when we think about the comparisons, and again, that's true across the provinces, of there's still a lot of work to do in addressing why child welfare, how the system has come to where it is now, addressing the overrepresentation and being able to have, like, meaningful engagement that supports youth aging out of care and that supports the social workers and other child welfare workers to be able to work with Indigenous youth and communities in a way that's really meaningful and supportive, and that's coming from Indigenous leadership and respecting and upholding Indigenous rights and sovereignty.
This is People First Radio. We're talking about youth aging out of care across Canada on today's program. Earlier on, we heard from Jackie Gehagan, Associate Vice President of Research at Mount St. Vincent University in Halifax. Gehagan is also a former youth in care. Let's get you back to our conversation. I understand that this is a subject you have personal experience with. Is there anything you can share about that?
Yeah, I mean, I would say in talking to folks who have care experience, much more current care experience than I did, my care experience was in the 70s, you know, I say to them, you know, this is my experience, how was your experience? And the comment is often, I'm not sure that anything has really changed, sadly, so sorry about that. So, you know, that's the problem is, we know this is an issue, we know it's still affecting kids in care, and we still haven't figured out a way of addressing what is, you know, maybe 65,000 kids in Canada. That feels like a very doable project, and why in 2025, almost 2026, we're still having the same conversations about what happens to these kids when the state, as their parents, says, okay, bye-bye, you're on your own now, figure it out yourself. That is not really setting these kids up for success. And the other thing that's a real kicker is we still see very low educational attainment. So that means less than 50% of kids from care actually finish high school. So imagine how different your life would be, Joe, if you didn't finish high school, and what you would be doing now. What I would be doing now? Definitely not what I'm currently doing. So the point is, education can have a transformational, lifelong impact on the individual, their life chances, their health outcomes, their social outcomes, et cetera. So it's a really, really, really important thing to figure out, both in terms of policy, as well as sort of, you know, on the grounds, programmatic responses to address these gaps.
You said there, when you talk about some parts of your own experience in the 70s with people who have been in care more recently, they say it sounds like not much has changed. What are some of the things that you're talking about there that haven't changed?
Well, I mean, this is a really sad descriptor, but sort of feeling like you're a piece of furniture. So moving from place to place, home to home, school to school, and not having that sense of attachment or sense of belonging. So that is part of what's contributing to low educational attainment. But the other thing that's contributing to that is just sort of fundamentally low expectations for educational outcomes for kids in care. So, you know, I reflect on my time in care, and there's certainly nobody talking to me about, when you grow up, what do you want to become? Which university do you think you're going to go to next fall? I don't recall having any of those kinds of conversations. And lots of the kids in care that are part of our SHRC grant have said the same thing. They didn't have that conversation like many, many parents or guardians might have with their kids, you know, as they inch towards finishing high school. These are kids that don't even finish high school. So imagine suddenly you haven't finished high school, you've turned 18 or 19, whatever the age, aging out age is in the province or territory you find yourself living in, and you need to figure it out from there. Like, that seems pretty extraordinary when you consider that Canada has signed on to the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of the Child, and yet here we are failing this really important, really invisible subset of kids in our own country.
Now, as mentioned before, the Senate of Canada, a committee of the Senate of Canada, has been looking into this issue. They recently put out a report. It made some recommendations. You spoke to that committee last year. What do you make of the work that they have done?
Well, I think it's great that they actually did this report. I'm pleased to see some of the recommendations that I put forward, and other people I know who gave expert testimony put forward. And one of my big issues, and I'm thrilled to see it in there, it is recommendation number 4, we need a national database. So my ask was, if we've got Statistics Canada that can do all sorts of magical things with data, census data, et cetera, can we not have a subset of data specifically on, obviously anonymized data, on kids from care to look at their health, social, educational, and other outcomes across the life course? So we know what's working and what's not working. Instead, we have a bit of a black box approach, which means we don't have good data. We can't tell whether BC is doing substantially better than Nova Scotia or Ontario or Quebec. We're not actually collecting comparable data where those data are being collected, and they certainly are not being readily, that data is not being readily available. So recommendation number 4 about a national database is music to my ears.
On the data point, what are some of the things that we know and can definitively say on this issue of youth aging out of care? And on the other side of that, what are things that we absolutely have no idea of?
So I would say the one data point that we're sadly familiar with is the lack of educational attainment. So, you know, it tends to be provincial studies, often funded by, ironically enough, government funds, so federal government or provincial funding, to look at these issues of educational attainment among care experienced youth. And what we see in larger provinces where the data have been collected more frequently is a less than 50% chance of completing high school. And, you know, well under 10% of kids from care complete post-secondary. So, you know, depends on which province or territory you're looking at. But what we're asking for, what I asked for in my expert testimony, was, can we please have a national database so we can see how are provinces and territories doing relative to each other on really important indicators like education? So education is one that I think is, there's some data there for sure, but things such as, you know, health outcomes. So do we see higher rates of depression, higher rates of poor mental health outcomes across the board? Do we see better sort of resiliency among kids in care? What are we seeing in terms of their mental health outcomes? And we don't have a good sense of that. Again, it is ultimately a bit of a patchwork from coast to coast to coast in Canada. So there's lots of things that we don't know, and we're extrapolating from limited study-related data or provincial data where it's available, or we're looking at what are other similar sort of OECD countries doing around these kinds of indicators of health, social, economic, and other outcomes for kids with care experience.
I want to ask you about barriers to change on this front, but there's something else I want to ask you that maybe it makes sense to mention at the same time off the top of the conversation. You mentioned you wrote an article about this in 2022, and that was the first time in your career you'd received angry hate mail. And I'm wondering if you could just tell me more about what that was like and why you think that was.
Well, it was not the most fun ever, to put it that way, Joe. So it was a bit shocking to me because this was a piece that we wrote in the Conversation Canada, which is a wonderful, wonderful platform to get research findings out into the sort of general readership, not just in Canada, but pieces in the Conversation go all over the world. It's an amazing platform. So this was one of the early pieces that we wrote based on our SHRC study. And some of the comments were, you know, why should I have to pay for somebody else's kids? Not my problem. I got my own expenses to worry about, et cetera. So rather than seeing the social good or the sort of public benefit of investing in kids from care who by no fault of their own, find themselves with the state as their parent, I think we can be a little bit more compassionate, a little bit more tolerant, a little bit more understanding that kids in care don't choose to be moved around like a piece of furniture. And yet we see far worse, based on the limited available data, far worse educational and other types of outcomes. So to have, you know, people say, well, why should I care about this? You know, what do you say in response to that, Joe? Like, we should care because if it affects one person, that's one person too many. And we should pay attention to the fact that the ripple effect of intergenerational trauma is a thing, which means kids that grow up in care who experience multiple forms of intersecting trauma then grow up having to deal with that for the rest of their lives. And that is, you know, that is not something that anyone would wish, I think, that anyone would wish on a kid anywhere in the world, let alone here in Canada, that sort of touts itself as, you know, having the leading edge on human rights related issues. And many other countries look to Canada for their leadership, for our leadership in human rights, including our own human rights code. And here we are feeling this group of kids and people feeling quite comfortable and saying, not my problem. Why should I have to pay for this? Somebody else's problem.
Jackie Gahagan is Associate Vice President of Research at Mount St. Vincent University in Halifax.
People First Radio and Media are Vancouver Island Mental Health Society education and awareness programs.
Today's program is taking a look at the issue of youth aging out of care across Canada. The Standing Senate Committee on Human Rights has released a new report on the issue called Nothing to Celebrate: The Crisis of Youth Aging Out of Care. Melanie Doucette is Executive Director of the National Council of Youth in Care Advocates. She spoke with the Senate committee last year as an expert witness. I asked her for her takeaways from the new report.
Well, this was stemming from a study on youth aging out of care in Canada that was launched by the Senate Committee on Human Rights in fall of 2024. And it was very much stemming from the advocacy that we've been doing at the National Council of Youth and Care Advocates. We have Senator Wanda Bernard, who actually has been championing this study, and we've had multiple conversations with her about the issues that we've been seeing across Canada, as well as Senator Kim Pate, who also sits on the committee. They've been very good champions for us in our advocacy. I was an expert witness to the hearings that they held in the fall of 2024, and several of our National Council members were also called as expert witnesses. And our testimony told them this has been an ongoing issue for decades and decades. There's been report after report coming out, whether it's like a child and youth advocate from a province or territory or a youth and care network, the same kind of recommendations are coming out to indicate that Canada as a nation does not have standards when it comes to the transition to adulthood for youth in care. And we're actually one in six of all the Western countries that don't have kind of a national framework or national legislation or an act that kind of establishes the right to equitable supports and services. So we have been advocating for this for a while, and there is a role for the federal government to play. I think that oftentimes the argument that's used is, oh, well, child protection isn't really federal government jurisdiction, but there's other countries who operate kind of similarly where the states have jurisdiction over child welfare services, but the federal government or the central government is still involved in some shape or form. For example, in the US, they actually have a national piece of legislation that entices the states to establish post-majority support programs and gives them funding to entice. And then in return, they have to report back in terms of how effective these programs are and on outcomes. That's why in the States, they have such rich data when it comes to the outcomes of youth aging out of care. And Canada doesn't even know how many youth age out of care every year on a national level, because we don't collect that data nationally, and the provinces and territories aren't obligated to publicly report on that data. And so it's very important, I think, for Canada, the federal government, to take responsibility and accountability in this, because eventually young people are going to age out into systems that the federal government is responsible for, such as, you know, housing and homelessness, poverty, the criminal justice system, and so on. So it really does impact the federal government eventually when things aren't invested in or prevented. And so we're hoping to see a bit more of collaboration between the federal government and the provinces and territories on this issue. And we're hoping that the equitable standards that I was talking about earlier, they're actually featured in the recommendations of the report as a kind of national framework and a guide to establish a national plan on this issue. And we're really looking forward to what that entails in terms of next steps.
Yeah, let's talk about some of those recommendations. So those recommendations include a National Children and Youth Commissioner, whose job would essentially be to report on this issue and go to the politicians in Ottawa and update them, calls for a national database on this, calls for a framework to implement human rights commitments that maybe the government of Canada is making in international settings. And then you're suggesting now that the situation is on the ground, it's actually, well, the province will deal with that. And there's a bit of a dissonance there. What do you make of the recommendations and how you feel they will address this issue?
Well, the recommendations are exactly in line with what everyone was saying at the hearings in the fall of 2024. Myself and Dr. Varda Manfeder from Concordia University, we co-authored a policy brief that we released in 2021 that basically called for all of these things as well. I think the lack of a national child and youth advocate or a commissioner is detrimental, because there's no checks and balances in terms of the commitments of the government of Canada to respect, you know, the rights of children and youth, especially vulnerable children and youth, including those in care. There's no kind of checks and balances there. And that's something that's very much needed. And this is something that we've been advocating for years now. And the national database recommendation is also something academics have been calling for this for a really long time, because again, if there's no obligation to publicly report on things such as how many youth age out of care every year, what happens to them? Are they graduating high school? Are they overrepresented in homelessness? Are they, you know, all of these things, then how are we supposed to move forward with concrete actions that are backed by evidence? And so that's something that we've also been waiting for a long time to see. And in terms of having a national plan guided by the equitable standards, I mean, we're thrilled to see that because the standards were developed, you know, from a lived experience lens. And we think it's time that people with lived experience actually be welcomed at the table as experts on this issue, because we are. We know best what works and what doesn't, and we should be informing how the system reforms and changes, including any new policies or pieces of legislation that arise from this. So I guess the recommendations are fantastic. It just, we're just waiting to see if there's actually actions that are going to be stemming from that.
You have experienced the transition out of care. You work with people who have experienced the transition out of care. Is there anything in either your own or the experiences of the people that you work with, anything that you've heard that you think would stick with people in a way that maybe talking about Senate committees and recommendations might have a harder time doing?
Yeah, I think when you just come to like the basics of it, youth in care want to be treated with as much value and importance and compassion and love as any other kid would, be treated by their parents in the general population. So whenever, you know, we speak to politicians or even like frontline workers, it's like, just treat them like a human being and treat them like you would treat your own children. Like, would you want your child to be in the street with no supports? No, then why is that acceptable for youth in care? It shouldn't be, and it isn't. And so that's really what youth in care are asking for, is like just basic human decency and care and supports that allow them to succeed and thrive as adults instead of getting crumbs and barely surviving.
Is there something, some reason you think that that situation you're suggesting has been perpetuated for decades and decades and decades? Like, what is the disconnect that is allowing that to continue to happen?
Well, I think it depends on, the political party that's in power, on what their priorities are. And oftentimes youth in care aren't even discussed as part of political platforms when you look at, you know, elections, whether provincial, territorial, or federal. And I think oftentimes it's an issue that's been kind of made invisible that the general public isn't really aware of. But when you do raise awareness about it, like, for example, in British Columbia, the Vancouver Foundation did a lot of work in this area on a campaign that was called the Fostering Change Campaign. And they surveyed the general population in terms of, would they want their tax dollars to go towards supporting young people in care for longer, so past the age of majority? And when most people were made aware of all the issues, they said, yes, of course, because that's what I would want for my kid. You know, I don't kick them out the door at 18 or 19. I help them. Sometimes I help them with their post-secondary education. Sometimes I still house them, you know. So I think that's something that people need to be maybe a bit more aware of across the country. And I think also the fact that the system has kind of turned into, I call it the professionalization of social work, in a sense where the system is more about operating as a business rather than a relationship-based human-to-human kind of rapport and support. And I think we need to kind of return to that, like where it's humans helping other humans and really wanting them to succeed instead of, you know, looking at it as an expense or a budget that needs to be balanced. These are like human beings that, you know, just a little gesture can literally change the course of their lives, and they're worth investing in. You know, that's something that I actually learned when I was doing my master's. I took a class in economics, and I learned then how the government treats, you know, buildings and things like that as investments, but people as expenditures. And I think there's something so inherently wrong with that approach. People are actually worthy of being seen as investments and should be treated as such.
How can the government do that? How can the government take a more relational approach to an issue like youth aging out of care? How does a solution to this have meaning beyond, you know, like the government decides we're going to cut someone a few checks until they're 25 instead of 18? Like, how do you make a change on the relational level?
Yeah, I think it has to be a cultural shift in terms of how the system has been operating, you know, moving away from the medicalized kind of clinical way of doing things where you're just kind of running assessments and putting notes in your case file and just going from case to case and treating children and youth as cases instead of, you know, human beings that need nurturing and support, and also have, you know, are not just like a crisis or a problem to solve. They have like talents and dreams and strengths and, you know, things that are positive in their life that needs highlighting and nurturing. So I think there needs to be a cultural shift that happens. And the equitable standards that we put forward really highlight this. We highlight that the supports need to be done within a holistic, trauma-informed approach, and really needs to be relational with the worker. Instead of, you know, very medicalized and very kind of rudimentary approach, because that doesn't work with teenagers, first of all. You can't work in that cold kind of, you know, paternalistic manner. And it requires some degree of like power sharing and exploring, trial and error. And I think this is something that's missing in a lot of cases with youth in care at this time. And I would even say for those governments that are skeptical and that are a bit more concerned about funding and how much is this going to cost, there's actually been cost-benefit analysis on this in terms of extending care up to age 25. There was one done by the Child and Youth Advocate of Ontario when they were still in place. And they showed that for every dollar invested until age 25, the return would be $1.25 over a young person's lifetime. And so the argument is also there fiscally. It's fiscally smart and responsible to invest in young people beyond the age of majority, and even more so to do it in a way that's holistic, wraparound, and trauma-informed.
If I'm a young person, I'm maybe 20 years old and I've aged out of the foster system, when I need advice about some big life thing that I might conventionally go to a trusted adult in my life to get, like, what is that situation like for someone in their very late teens, early 20s who was aged out of the foster system?
Yeah, young people in care, for the most part, don't tend to have supportive people in their lives that aren't paid to be there. And I think that's usually the issue when youth age out, is they lose all these formal connections that they've made during their time in care. So people who are mandated to be in their lives, people who are paid to be in their lives, like their social worker, their foster parent, and so on. And so if informal relationships haven't been nurtured for young people while they were in care, they're very isolated once they leave the system, because all those other types of relationships that they had were cut off because they're mandated to end. And so for us at the National Council, we advocate first and foremost that youth in care can't have just formal relationships in their lives. They have to have people who care about them, aren't paid to care about them, and want to be involved in their lives, like mentors in the community, friends, extended family, etc. And that those types of relationships need to be accorded with just as much importance during their time in care than the formal ones. And they have to be nurtured and supported so that they can accompany them when they're transitioning to adulthood. So sometimes, you know, what will happen is a young person will, you know, be living in their first apartment and they don't have someone to call to teach them how to properly do laundry, or even know, like, is this food bad? It smells kind of weird. I don't know if I should eat it. You know, like just really like mundane questions that, you know, people would think, oh, you know, it's easy to get support on that. I could just call my aunt or uncle or my mom and dad, and they don't have that. And so it can put them in a place where they feel really isolated, and sometimes also put them in a place where they're taken advantage of. Like if you think about like, you know, renting in an apartment, they wouldn't know like what's legal or illegal in terms of being asked to leave or being evicted and things like that. So it's really important for young people and in from care to have, you know, informal connections and people that care about them that can help them during those times. And that's not the norm at all currently.
What's the way for a system to help people have those?
Yeah, like I mentioned, I think as soon as a young person enters care, whether it's as a child or as a teenager, they need to wrap around all these people that either have been previously in their life or are currently in their life, and identify those people with the young person. So, you know, have ongoing conversations about like, who is it in your life that you feel has made a positive impact on you? Is it someone that you're still in touch with, or someone you've previously been in touch with but lost touch? Let's reconnect. Let's make those, you know, forge those relationships. Developing like mentorship programs, like, for example, like Big Brothers, Big Sisters, having programs that are targeted to youth in care so that they have a mentor in their life. Things like that. It's like not impossible to, you know, establish these things. It just takes that extra, you know, effort and intention to realize that young people in from care need those types of people in their life. And we need to be strategic about how we get these people involved in their lives.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to the conversation today on this?
Yeah, I think, you know, people with lived experience have a lot to say about this topic, and rightfully so. Most of us have had really challenging experiences during our time in care. And, you know, even though I aged out of care very long time ago, like 25 plus years ago, there's a lot of things that are still happening to this day to young people who are aging out of care today. And I think young people and older people who have had lived experience in the child welfare system, they need to be at decision-making tables when it comes to making change. And that includes, you know, at federal decision-making tables, as well as provincial and territorial, because like I mentioned earlier, we're the ones that should be leading the charge for the change, because we know what works and what doesn't. And we should be the ones that kind of are leading that conversation and the steps to take to change the system.
Are there any of those things that you suggested, you know, you experienced them circa 25 years ago, and now you're talking to people and hearing that they've had the exact same experiences? Are there any of those things that you'd like to highlight for us?
Yeah, I guess for me, I didn't receive a whole lot of training in terms of how to live on my own, what my rights were as a tenant, what a credit score was. I didn't even know what that meant. And when I actually had to open up accounts for my power bill and things like that, they were like, oh, you have no credit score, so you have to put like a big deposit in order to be able to open electric account or whatever. And I had zero idea. I was like, I don't even know what a record, what a credit score is. And I felt really embarrassed, you know, at the time. I think preparing young people for that transition to adulthood, as soon as they enter care, they need to have, just like a parent would do for their own kid, you know, in the outside world, outside of the child welfare system, it has to be nurtured in that way, so that it's not a surprise when they reach, you know, 18 or 19, that they don't feel like they're caught off guard or shocked or surprised about these things because they've been accompanied into it. And I would say, like, you know, I never was taught how to properly budget, how to save, even like what employment insurance is, how to access it. Like, there's so many things that I had to really learn on my own and that I shouldn't have had to. And, you know, the system or the ministry, when they take a kid or a young person into care, what they're saying is, we're going to do a better job than your parents. And we are now your legal guardian. And to me, it's like, if you're actually claiming that, then back it up with some action, because if you actually look at how they're doing and the fact that they kick people out at the age of 18 or 19, they're actually not doing a better job. And sometimes I would say even worse job. So I think the system has a lot of accountability and responsibility to take on, but I think they need to do that alongside young people in and from care.
Melanie Doucette is Executive Director of the National Council of Youth in Care Advocates. Our conversation was prompted by a report from the Standing Senate Committee on Human Rights looking at the issue of youth aging out of care. The report is available online. It's called Nothing to Celebrate: The Crisis of Youth Aging Out of Care. That's it for the show today. I'm Joe Pugh. You've been listening to People First Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.